Welcome to the Poem of the Week. Each week, our poems are intended to help you practice the best, most current medicine by alerting you to studies that could change your practice. As usual, our host this week is National Public Radio's Dr. Michael Wilkes and Essential Evidence Senior Editor Dr. Mark A. Bell. Gentlemen.
Good day, Mark.
Hi, Mike.
We have a great poem that you chose this month. It takes us in a different direction than what we usually talk about. It's not about a chronic disease. It's about perhaps a growing problem. It deals with traumatic brain injury. Listeners will know that that involves some sort of contact to the head, usually an acceleration or deceleration force, and it causes some sort of injury. Mild traumatic brain injury is often called TBI, is typically defined by a mild Glasgow coma scale of between 13 and 15, usually typically measured about 30 minutes after an injury. In the old days, we used to use the word concussion, and in many places, it's still a synonym for TBI. The American Academy of Neurology defines concussion as a trauma-induced alteration in mental status that may or may not involve consciousness. Definitions of mild TBI often do not explicitly require a normal head CT, although that is often done if someone's brought to the hospital. A minority of patients who present with these mild TBIs are found to have significant intracranial abnormalities, sometimes including a contusion or a hemorrhage, either subarachnoid or subdural or epidural, et cetera, and those obviously need to be followed up. When we look sort of globally at the epidemiology of this, about 3 million people sustain these TBIs in the United States every year. Just by comparison, that's a huge number. Luckily, the vast majority of those are mild. The estimates of the causes of TBI, motor vehicles is at the top, then falls, occupational accidents, recreational accidents, which we're going to talk about in a moment, and assaults is next. The recreational ones, Mark and I were talking before we recorded about the use of some of these new scooters. Also way up there is sports. And according to the American Academy of Neurology, American football is at the top, followed by ice hockey, soccer, boxing, and rugby. In football alone, an estimated 10% of American colleges and 20% of American high school players sustain these injuries each year. So this is not something uncommon, and our listeners could easily be encountering these sorts of injuries in their practice. Marx found a poem that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2019. It starts on page 1801, and it attempts to answer the question, are former professional soccer players at increased risk for neurodegenerative disease? So in terms of long-term effects, is there any correlation? Mark, what did they find?
Yeah, thanks, Mike. That was a nice introduction. And the study looked at former professional soccer players in Scotland. So, you know, we know there's a connection or an association, at least a strong association, between repeated head trauma and chronic traumatic encephalopathy. This is what this study looked at soccer, which is thought to be perhaps safer. But of course, players are, you know, I watch soccer a lot. I'm, you know, my parents are from Germany. I grew up playing soccer. I watch the Bundesliga and the Premier League every weekend. And, you know, a professional soccer player will take a ball that travels 50 meters on their head. And there are not infrequently collisions between two players' heads when they're both going up for the ball at the same time. So those repeated injuries, the question is, do they have any consequences? So they looked at 7,600 former Scottish professional soccer players, and they merged the records of their playing time with electronic health records that included cause of death, medications, and then they matched them on a 1-to-3 basis based on age and socioeconomic status with people from the general population. So these players entered the study at age 40 and were followed for up to 18 years. The likelihood that any neurodegenerative disease was listed as the primary cause of death was significantly higher in former players than in controls, 1.7% versus 0.5%. After adjusting for competing causes of death and other factors, the risk remained the same. So the hazard ratio was 3.5, was 3.5 times more likely. any neurodegenerative disease was listed as either the primary or a contributing cause of death more often in former players. Hazard ratio, again, 3.5. The increase in risk was greatest for Alzheimer's disease with a hazard ratio of 5 and lowest for Parkinson's disease with a hazard ratio of 2. But those are still, you know, in the realm of probably not just a spurious association, but probably more likely to be causal given their magnitude. All these increases in risk were statistically significant as well. Former players were also 5 times more likely to have received medication for dementia than controls. Being a goalkeeper was somewhat protective, and they're less of those. They're not heading the ball. They still have the direct head-to-head contact injuries, though. And they had a somewhat lower likelihood of receiving dementia meds and a trend toward less diagnosed neurodegenerative disease than players out in the field. So bottom line, being a former professional soccer player in Scotland is associated with a greater risk of neurodegenerative disease and a greater likelihood of having prescribed medication for dementia. The number needed, if you will, to play pro soccer to harm is about 50 for one additional diagnosis of neurodegenerative disease. So there's some limitations to this kind of study. You know, it's retrospective data. It's relying on death certificates, which may not always be accurate. But it certainly provides, you know, some food for thought in terms of, you know, when kids should be playing. Should there be rule changes? You know, there's discussion around whether headers should be, you know, allowed in midfield, things like that. So anyway, it was an interesting study.
It's very interesting. I think it raises lots of questions for us as primary care doctors. If we accept that some of our responsibility has to do with prevention, the question is, what do we recommend? And it talked about the limitations of the retrospective design, but obviously it's not going to be very fruitful very quickly if we do prospective studies. So this may just be the best we've got. What do we tell our kids or the parents of our kids about what they should be doing?
Yeah, well, increasingly, soccer leagues are delaying the ability, you know, allowing headers in until adolescence, at least. And, you know, that's one of those kind of makes sense, but we really don't know if that's going to be truly protective or not. And it still leaves kids open to the direct collision kind of injuries that might occur, but probably less so if they're not going up with their heads trying to, you know, basically have two heads trying to occupy the same space where the ball is approaching. And so that's, I think, the more worrisome kind of injury. You know, and it leaves open the question of, is it the heading of the ball or is it the head-to-head contacts repeatedly? And, you know, if you watch, there's usually in most games, there are one or two of these kind of head-to-head collisions and the players are dazed and they don't have very good protocols in place, certainly not like football does now in the U.S. In terms of pulling players off. There's still a lot of sort of the macho thing about, oh, I'm fine and, you know, continuing to play.
Obviously, this study and the few others that I've come across, none of them address the issue of when these injuries are most critical. So this is looking downstream. But if you waited until adolescence, would that make a difference? I mean, perhaps it would, but
yeah, you don't know. And, you know, most of these are professional soccer players. So they typically would have begun very early in childhood.
Right.
And at a time when heading was completely allowed for 6-year-olds. I mean, I remember, you know, I was a referee, soccer referee as a growing up, and, you know, I would referee 6 and 7 year olds and they were heading the ball. So they probably have a professional soccer player might have 30 years of exposure to this potential kind of injury. Is 2 or 3 years of playing soccer in high school the same, going to have the same impact? Probably not. But, you know, again, there are a lot of open questions and this probably needs to be studied in players that aren't professional soccer players, but did, for example, youth soccer, right, and comparing those that began with heading and similar in, you know, early childhood versus later adolescence. There's a lot of work to be done on this.
Great. Thanks, Mark. It's an important topic. We'll keep our eye on this and bring new poems to listeners as they come across your desk. Thanks. We'll talk with you next week.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Well, that's this week's poem. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to read this and other recent poems, please go to www.essentialevidence.com. And please join us again next week for another medical poem.